Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. And last hour, we started this discussion with Eric Hoffman, professor at the University of London, professor of politics there, about identity politics, per his new book on shifting governing coalitions in Western Europe, some of that evinced by recent election results, not just Boris and Brexit, but election results in the Netherlands and Germany, where there has been a definitive move away from socialists and cultural Marxists into center-right populist parties. The interesting dynamic where you see a move away in the West from those parties who are proponents of identity politics, and yet you have Zach Beauchamp writing at Vox.com, supposedly one of the outlets for the next generation of leading lights of the left, that those on the left who think moderation is the order of the day when it comes to identitarian politics that are wrong, writing, a liberalism that rejects identity politics is a liberalism for the powerful, one that relegates the interests of marginalized groups to second-class citizen status. In point of fact, Beauchamp argues what we see happening before us, including with the ascent of Bernie Sanders, that no, we're not to moderate our position identity politics. Actually, we're to double down and make identity politics the central thesis of our offerings. For more on the topic, let's continue this discussion. Pleased to be joined by Spencer Klavan, who is the son of a friend of the show, Andrew Klavan, the great Hollywood screenwriter. Spencer is an assistant editor of the Claremont Review of Books and The American Mind, so chip off the old block in terms of being a writing talent. Spencer, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you recently for Claremont Review wrote a review of a book that was authored by Douglas Murray, who we've had on our show. His book I've read. I just want to start with your reaction to the position of the Beauchamps of the world on the left, that in point of fact, despite some recent electoral setbacks, the remedy for those setbacks is to double down and to extol the virtues of identity politics, which is what Douglas Murray identifies sort of the manifestations of identity politics in four segments in his book.
Right. It's not terribly surprising to me, I have to confess. I think one of the things that's most interesting about the Democratic primaries right now, as you can see the party almost pulling itself apart at the seams across this divide between what you might call true believers, the Zach Beauchamps of the world, who really have bought into this ideology, who believe certain people are marginalized, gay people, transgender people, women, and certain people are in power, mostly white cisgendered males. And the marginalized people need to be enfranchised at the expense of the people in power, the white cisgendered males. There's a genuine contingent on the left of people that believe this passionately, and they want to see candidates that are going to put those policies into effect. And every candidate in the Democratic field right now has to make some kind of gesture in that direction. But I think there's genuinely a large and growing but kind of silent, perhaps even majority of people that just see more and more how crazy this stuff is. And, you know, it's very hard to speak out, especially on the left, against identity politics, because one of the things it does is it demonizes anybody that speaks out against it. But I think that the Democrats right now are kind of pulling each other apart over exactly this question. Are we going to just double down on this stuff and really go for it? Or are we kind of making lip service to it, but really, you know, the Mike Bloombergs of the world, I don't think, actually want to go through with this kind of stuff. But, so it's a fascinating dynamic to watch.
But you know, once you foment it, you can't reel it back in. I mean, so it's the bullets out of the gun, it seems to me. So you can be genuine about it, or you can be disingenuous and just pantomiming support for these things like Bloomberg is. That's a good example, given just comments he's made on the topic relatively recently that are 180 degrees from where he is today. But once you unleash it, you know, how do you then restrain it?
No, I think that's right. I think that's part of the genius of Murray's title, The Madness of Crowds, that this mob psychology, you mentioned my dad, and something he's fond of saying is that the devil doesn't care if you're pretending to be evil or if you're sincerely evil eventually. You know, he gets you. And yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. The Mike Bloombergs of the world who are only gesturing at this stuff are going to find that it eats them alive. The only question for me on the table is whether some people eventually break away. And I think you see in the intellectual left, you see more and more people doing that. Movements like the Walk Away movement with Brandon Straka that says, you know, we've just had enough of this stuff. And whether there's going to be an official political expression for that in the form of a third party or whatever, I don't know. But yeah, if any Democrat sort of makes lip service to identity politics, you're right. He's really, he may not know it, but he's in it to win it, as it were.
When we come back with Spencer Klavan, I want to pick up this other question. One of the reasons these ideas have spread so quickly, become almost axiomatic, ideas that we weren't even talking about 5 minutes ago, like gender is just a social construct. One of the reasons they've spread so fast is because they're not being defended in a serious way. It sounds like a paradox. I want to discuss that with Spencer Klavan, assistant editor of the Claremont Review of Books. Back with more after this.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Spencer Klavan on The Dan Proft Show. He is the assistant editor of the Claremont Review of Books and The American Mind. He's written a review of Douglas Murray's book, The Madness of Crowds, that tackles not only that book, but the larger ideas contained within it. And Spencer, as I referenced before the break, you make the point about the speed, so does Douglas Murray and many other pundits. The speed at which this has taken hold and been adopted wholesale is sort of remarkable. It has a lot of people's heads spinning. But you say perhaps it's because these ideas haven't been logically defended in a serious way is the very reason they've spread so fast, which, you know, at first blush sounds oxymoronic.
Yeah, the example that I give in the piece is the two competing ideas. One, that gender is a social construct. It's a figment of our imagination. There's no such thing as male and female. But two, a person born biologically male can have some spiritual essential conviction that he's actually something called a woman, and that's a real thing, and that's what he is. So those are two ideas you actually can't hold in your mind at the same time. They contradict one another. And I think that in order to make those ideas palatable or to make them spread, you have to stop people from asking the question, well, how do those two things fit together? And the way that you do that is you make them scared. You call them terrible names if they don't agree with you that these things are true. And that is basically how identity politics functions more and more, especially in the universities, that people get no platformed or called bigot and liar and hounded out of the public square for even asking these questions. Actually, this Murray doesn't talk about this in his book so much, but I think abortion is another area in which this is really true, that the question before us about abortion, and we who are pro-life are constantly trying to ask the question, well, what is a person? What is the fundamental unit of human dignity? And the left will go to any extreme not to ask that question. Oh, it's about you're against a woman's right to choose, you're against women's freedom and health and so on, all just to distract from these very basic questions that haven't been answered by the logic of identity politics.
Isn't a working definition of sociopathology the ability to hold two contradictory thoughts in your mind at the same time? So, I mean, you can almost describe these things as sociopathic, these ideologies. You're right about that, too. And it's interesting, right? In lieu of making a serious argument, we just cower you to accepting our diktats.
That's right. Yeah. Sociopathy is certainly one fitting analogy for what's going on here. Interestingly, I think another analogy for what identity politics is a religion. Now, yeah. I'm a religious person. I believe in God. I'm a Christian. But I definitely think that you can have good religion and you can have bad religion. And when religion is removed from, say, the academy and the public square, something comes in to take its place.
Right. This is G.K. Chesterton's observation that those who stop believing in God don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And this is what we have playing out in real time. So if that's the case, and if this is not logic-based, if this isn't reasoned through, and it's spreading at the pace it's spreading, then how do you stop it? If it's not logic-based, can you stop it with logic, or does there need to be a new approach thought through?
That is a fantastic question, and it's something I begin to address at the end of this review. You know, the very first chapter of Plato's Republic, one of the greatest and earliest works of philosophy in the West, Socrates is getting in an argument with some of his friends, and they sort of half-jokingly, they say, well, how can you persuade us if we won't listen to you? And Socrates says, you're right, I can't. There's no way to persuade somebody that's not behaving or talking rationally. And so one of the binds that we get into when we try to address identity politics is we attempt to talk about ideas when there might be something much more primal going on and something much more structural. And I think for me, probably the way to go about answering that is to think much more carefully about education and not just about higher education, about the universities, but to look at what's going on, what's being taught in our public schools. Because by the time people get to university, they've already been trained and indoctrinated a lot of the time in some of these pre-rational or illogical ideas. I mean, I live in California, where our public school system has basically become legal transgender indoctrination. I mean, there are laws on the books now which mandate that children should be able to declare their own gender and to use facilities associated with that gender and so on. And parents and teachers and counselors, many of whom object, are powerless to do anything about that. And so that kind of educational reform, paying attention in schools and in law to what can and can't be taught in public schools to our kids, I think that's a good way to start getting around some of this craziness and illogic.
And it seems to me, this is very much like this discussion, this debate that's now been joined against the 1619 Project, the New York Times' 1619 Project, where it can't just be responding to this incomplete history of America, that America's racism is in its DNA, it's irreparably racist, slavery is the legacy, and it's the only thing of importance other than the ramifications of slavery. There are no stories of black resilience and black achievement, which of course punctuate American history. There's no complete accounting. But if you just operate from their premises and debate slavery, then you're essentially advancing their position. You have to have an alternative story about America that is comprehensive, that folds in a very real thing, slavery, racist institutions like Jim Crow, but provides the complete picture so people get a complete understanding. It seems to me one of the things that these cultural Marxist movements get away with is telling the incomplete story, and maybe the remedy is the complete story.
That's a fantastic example. The 1619 Project is a project that has been systematically debunked and disproven at every level by every major academic outlet. I mean, the Atlantic published a big piece about all of the factual inaccuracies in it. There have been socialist groups that have spoken out against it. There's a wonderful array of pieces by black scholars coming out and contesting a lot of the claims in the 1619 Project. Plenty of rational arguments to be made to demonstrate that this is a completely intellectually bankrupt project. And yet, the installation of the 1619 curriculum in schools carries on apace, because what people tend perhaps not to get is that it's not just about winning those arguments. It's about being committed to a project of indoctrination, which is what the 1619 Project is. And in order, as you say, in order to fight back against that, you have to have a positive project of education that you can use and be committed to installing in schools and teaching to kids.
He is Spencer Klavan, assistant editor of the Claremont Review of Books and The American Mind. Check out his review of Douglas Murray's new book, The Madison Crowds, called Going Off the Rails, which I'll tweet out. Spencer, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
I know who I want to take me home. I know who I want to take me home.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.